it's off, I'm gonna move it, is that okay? It's not doing anything. Well, top of the evening to you. If you want to be turning in your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 13, the goal tonight is to consider the second half of that chapter, which is where we left off the last time I spoke. And so just in order to set the context so that we can appreciate the chapter and the verses before us, you will recall that it was back in chapter 11 that we had David's sin with Bathsheba and her husband Uriah. It all started with a look. And that look became lust, and that lust became adultery, and adultery led to a pregnancy and a cover-up, and it ultimately ended in murder. All started with a look. And so one of the key verses that we find in chapter 11 is at the very end of the chapter, the very last sentence, and it says this. This is in connection with David's arrangement to have Uriah killed and all that had happened with Bathsheba. It says, "But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord." He had taken care of Uriah. On the surface, it might seem as though problem was solved, but not really. The thing that he had done displeased the Lord. And we know from the Psalms that he wrote that for a period of a year or more, David was a miserable man because he was living with unconfessed sin. And then we come to chapter 12 and we see he's confronted by God through Nathan the prophet. Nathan gives him a parable, the rich man and the poor man, and the poor man had one lamb, and the rich man took the poor man's one lamb, and David was really incensed by this parable. He was just furious, and it really got to his conscience, and he says, that man ought to pay fourfold, and then he ought to be put to death. And then Nathan said, "You're that man. You're that man." And David, convicted of his sin, at last repented of his sin and came to know the forgiveness that God offers those who are willing to repent. He was genuinely repentant. His Psalms indicate that. And he was genuinely forgiven. Genuinely forgiven. But, as we noted, though sin can be forgiven, consequences remain. You know, God has given us a free will. He has given us a certain degree of autonomy, and he allows us to make the choice to sin. We can choose to sin, but we can't choose the consequences of our sin. That's up to God. And so when David was presented with this parable by Nathan and convicted of his sin, Nathan went on to tell David that there will be consequences to your sin. We saw in verse 10, he said, "Now therefore the sword shall never depart thine house because thou hast despised me," and so forth. In the next verse, "I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house." In other words, David, you're going to have trouble with your children. You're going to have trouble with your children. And so we recognize the fact that though someone can genuinely repent of their sin and be forgiven and even enjoy fellowship with God and a degree of intimacy with God, all at the same time that they're under the discipline of God. And so the principles that we read in the New Testament, the law of the harvest, for example, if you sow to the flesh, you shall of the flesh reap corruption. David is the poster child for that. you reap what you sow. The law of the harvest was true in the New Testament dispensation. It was true in the Old Testament economy as well, along with the principle that we read in Hebrews chapter 12, whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth. True for our dispensation, it was true in those days too. And so David was going to come to know something of the chastening of the Lord, and it wasn't going to take long. God will never compromise his mercy or extend mercy at the expense of justice. And so we come to chapter 13 and we begin to see some of the consequences of his sin. We read about David's beautiful daughter named Tamar. We looked at this last time, the first half of this chapter. And we saw how that David had another son named Amnon. It was his firstborn son. He was heir to the throne. And he became infatuated with his sister Tamar. She was very beautiful. And he just was obsessed, literally obsessed with her. He was determined to have her. But there was no means to get to her, as it were. And so his cousin Jonadab devised a plan whereby Amnon would pretend to be sick, and when his father David checked on him, he would request from his father that Tamar come and feed him, cook him some of her special cakes, you know. And so using this ploy, he was able to get her alone in his bedroom, and ultimately he forced her. He raped her. He raped her. And then once he had, satisfied the desires of his flesh, he cast her out. We read in verse 15, such a sobering verse. This is 2 Samuel 12 and verse 15. Then Amnon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred wherewith he hated her was greater than the love wherewith he had loved her. And Amnon said unto her, arise, be gone. And we noted there that sin is attractive in anticipation or in prospect, but it's repulsive in retrospect. So this woman that he was so infatuated with, that he was determined to have, once he satisfied that fleshly desire, she was disposable. He just said, arise and be gone. It wrecked her life. She was disgraced and she was ashamed, and it was just a horrible thing. Tamar found herself as the object of a man's intense lust through no fault of her own. I see nothing in the narrative to suggest that in any way she provoked him. I personally don't think she had any idea that he was burning in this desire to have her. There's no indication of that, and there was nothing she did that was of a provocative nature. She was just oblivious to all this. She became the object of a man's lust through no fault of her own. And I was thinking back on that, and I just was going to mention that while it's possible to become the object of a man's lust through no fault of your own, it's also possible to become the object of a man's lust through provocative dress and behavior, the way a woman presents herself. And I just, I know this is a sensitive subject, but it's worth, getting it out and open. We need to recognize that for women, young women in particular, need not to do anything that's going to cause a man to have those kind of desires. No young lady wants to be disgraced and taken advantage of, and so it's important to recognize that a modest behavior the kind of behavior that Peter talks about in 1 Peter chapter 3, where he talks about a woman's dress. He says, 1 Peter chapter 3 speaks of verse 2, her chaste conversation coupled with fear, whose adorning let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair, of wearing of gold, or putting on of the apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart, and that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. That's what's to be attractive in the life of a woman, that inner beauty. And so just to recognize that. So now, Amnon has raped Tamar, and then he's cast her aside. Now, so she's been not only disgraced, but she's been discarded. Now, there are two Old Testament laws that come into play here that are worth recognizing. The first one is in Deuteronomy chapter 22. Deuteronomy chapter 22, in verses 28 and 29, address this very situation. And this is what it says. If a man find a damsel that is a virgin, which is not betrothed, and lay hold on her and lie with her, and they be found, then the man that lay with her shall give unto the damsel's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife. Because he hath humbled her, he may not put her away all his days. So, a woman who is a virgin, who is not betrothed, who is basically raped, that law, those verses make it clear that the man is supposed to marry her. He's supposed to pay the dowry and he's supposed to marry her. Of course, Amnon wasn't interested in that. Nor was David, by the way, interested in enforcing that. But the other law is in Leviticus chapter 20. And it's even more specific. Leviticus chapter 20 and verse 17 says this. And if a man shall take his sister, his father's daughter, which is exactly what we have here, his father's daughter, or his mother's daughter, and see her nakedness, and she see his nakedness, it is a wicked thing, and they shall be cut off in the sight of their people. He hath uncovered his sister's nakedness, he shall bear his iniquity. So that law was even more specific. It deals with incest, and it's called a wicked thing, and they were to be cut off. And yet, Amnon despised her. He wasn't the least bit interested in marrying her. He got what he wanted, and you know, a few minutes of pleasure on his part wrecked her life forever, okay? And he was not only unrepentant, but David failed to discipline him. David, his father, failed to discipline him. And of course, as we're going to see, that came at a great price. But then, you know, you ask the question, you know, how could he discipline his son for moral failure, for sexual sin, when he was guilty of the same thing? You see, when we compromise our testimony, people are not going to listen. And that's exactly what David had done. He was really not in a position where he could discipline Amnon, because he was just as guilty. He was guilty of lust and adultery and murder. And here he is going to turn around and discipline Amnon for very similar sins. And it just didn't happen. But David, it seemed, had problems disciplining his sons in the first place. It was very interesting. This morning, I was reading in the book of Esther, and I came across this verse, and I've noted it before, but I just want to read one verse from chapter 2 of Esther. This was after, Mordecai had given her instructions to be careful not to reveal the fact that she was a Jew. She was the queen now. Anyway, it said, Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people, as Mordecai had charged her. You know, she grew up, in the home of Mordecai, her uncle. Okay, she had not showed her kindred nor people as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther, listen to this, for Esther did the commandment of Mordecai like as when she was brought up with him. In other words, she was obedient. She was obedient to his request not to reveal who she was, the fact that she was a Jew, because she was used to being obedient. Okay? Now, I want you to contrast that with what we read when we come to 1 Kings chapter 1, and we read about another one of David's sons, Adonijah, who was another one of his problem sons. And we read concerning Adonijah, who tried to challenge his kingship. It says there in chapter 1, then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king, and prepared chariots and horsemen and so forth. Listen to verse 6. And his father had not displeased him at any time in saying, why hast thou done so? In other words, he was totally undisciplined. He never called his son out for doing anything wrong. He let his son do whatever he wanted. He let his son run wild. And what did his son? How did his son respond? Well, he lost total respect for his father. Now compare that with Esther and her obedience to Mordecai. Now, I don't want to get too far off on this, but it's really pretty exciting. I was just thinking about this morning. You know, there were several key instances in the history of the nation of Israel where they were literally on the brink of extinction, where the messianic line was about to be cut off. And this was one of them. And I'm not going to get into the story of Esther, you know it already. But an integral part of the way things turned out was the fact that she was obedient to Mordecai. Had she not been, had she revealed who she was, it would have been a totally different story. And the messianic line depended on the Jews not being exterminated, because that's exactly what Haman wanted to do, kill all the Jews. Anyway, David had a problem when it came to disciplining his children. So now we come to our point in chapter 13, after Tamar has been disgraced, she's been discarded, he wanted nothing to do with her, he threw her out, locked the door, and she took and put ashes on her head, tore her garment, put her hand on her head, and went out crying. And then Absalom, verse 20, her brother said unto her, hath Amnon thy brother been with thee? But now hold thy peace, my sister, he is thy brother, regard not this thing. So Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. So Absalom got wind of what had happened, and he was not happy about the fact that his brother, the firstborn and heir to the throne, by the way, had raped his sister Tamar, his beautiful, lovely, beloved sister, that Amnon had raped her. He was not one bit happy about that. And he took her in. He took her in. I mean, her life was shattered. He took her in. And we read in verse 21, we read David's response. When King David heard of all these things, he was very wroth. He was furious. He was furious. And Absalom, verse 22, spake unto his brother Amnon, neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar. Verse 23, and it came to pass after 2 full years. After 2 full years. Now let's just stop for a moment and think about what those 2 years were like for the different characters in the narrative. 2 years passed. for Tamar, it was 2 years of being disgraced, dejected, and brokenhearted. For David, it was 2 years of anger and heartbreak and sorrow over what had happened to his daughter, and anger towards his son Amnon that had raped her. David was very wroth. He was furious. And I'm sure that that anger only grew and festered over those 2 years. And Absalom, what happened to Absalom during those 2 years? Well, Absalom, in so many words, told his sister, "I'll take care of it." And he was very careful not to even speak to Amnon. Okay? They were not on good terms from here on out. And so during that 2 years, Absalom was looking for a way that he could get revenge. He could retaliate against his brother that had forced his sister. So that's what was going on during those two full years. It says, Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal Hazor, which is beside Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons. Now this was a big deal. The sheep shearing was quite a time of celebration and rejoicing. It was a time of having a big meal and celebrating and all. And so Absalom decided to invite the whole family. Okay, he invited all the king's sons. Verse 24, and Absalom came to the king and said, "Behold now, thy servant hath sheep shears. Let the king, I beseech thee, and his servants go with thy servants." And the king said to Absalom, "Nay, my son, let us not all now go, lest we be chargeable unto thee." And he pressed him, howbeit he would not go, but blessed him. So when Absalom invites his father respectfully declines. He said, "No, I don't want to be a burden." We don't know exactly what he meant there. Maybe it would be too many people. Maybe it would be too costly. But for whatever reason, he declined. But he gave his blessing. Don't you know, in hindsight, he must have looked back at that time. Just as he looked back when he told Tamar to go into the bedroom and minister to her brother Amnon, who was faking a sickness. Don't you know how he regretted that day? And he's going to come to regret this day as well, where he gives his blessing to this celebration of the sheep shearing. And then said Absalom, he says, "If not, I pray thee," this is verse 26, "let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said unto him, "Why would he go with thee?" You know, David seems a little suspicious. I mean, I'm sure he was aware of the fact that for 2 years, these two brothers hadn't spoken. And, you know, it's sort of odd that he would single out, of all the brothers, he would single out Amnon. And so David says, why should he go with thee? But Absalom pressed him that he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. So David gave in and he says, "Okay, I won't go, but I'll give my blessing upon all of my sons, including Amnon, to go to this sheep shearing." Verse 28. Now Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, "Mark ye now when Amnon's heart is merry with wine." In other words, when he's had too much to drink, he's a little tipsy. "And when I say unto you, smite Amnon, then kill him. Fear not. Have not I commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant." It's got a familiar ring to it, doesn't it? So Absalom tells his men, you know, wait till he's had a few drinks. He's a little unsteady on his feet, not as well able to defend himself. And once he's had a few drinks, it'll be easier for me to accomplish my goal, which is to kill him. Does that sound familiar? Get him drunk so I can accomplish my goal. Isn't that exactly what David did with Uriah? After he was unsuccessful at getting Uriah to go home and stay with his wife and spend the night with his wife, he finally said, well, let's get him drunk and then maybe he'll go home. But that didn't work either. So we've got a like father, like son going on here. Get him drunk and then kill him. And you know, this verse is, if you really stop and think about it, it is such a testimony to the depravity of man's heart. And here he is, Absalom is telling his men, he says, you know, when I give the word, then kill him. Fear not. Be courageous. Be valiant. Now, fear not. Be courageous. Be valiant. Wait a minute. You're talking about killing your brother. This is not Joshua chapter 1 where God is sending Joshua and the Israelites forth into the land of Canaan to conquer and to be courageous and to be fearless and to be valiant and I'm with you and all this kind of stuff. This is a man talking about killing his own brother. This is amazing. So let's see what happened. Verse 29, and the servants of Absalom did unto Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and every man got him up upon his mule and fled. So the plan worked. Absalom has killed his brother now. And notice five times you'll notice, and this is interesting to me, I'm not sure the full significance of it, but five times in this chapter, in the second half of this chapter, you read the phrase, all the king's sons. They all arose and got every man up upon his mule and fled. It's just that Absalom fled in one direction and all the king's sons went the 8 miles to Jerusalem. They headed southwest and Absalom headed north because he had just murdered somebody. And that somebody was his own brother. And capital murder was a capital crime. So he suddenly became a fugitive. And so what does he do? He fled, and we read about that in a little bit. But verse 30, and it came to pass while they were in the way. So they're headed back to Jerusalem. The sons are, all but Absalom. While they were in the way, that tidings came to David, saying, Absalom hath slain all the king's sons, and there's not one of them left. Well, that's not true. But somehow that's the story that made it back to the king while the sons were still en route. Now, just imagine what it would be like. I mean, it would be horrible enough to lose one son. But to get a report that all your sons, that's sort of what happened to Job. He lost his whole family of kids in one fell swoop. Unimaginable. And so the word came that all the sons were dead. Of course, it was wrong. But you can imagine. No, you can't imagine. None of us can imagine what that would feel like to think that, like that, all your sons are dead. Now, I mean, if for no other reason, what about all those promises that God made through the prophet back in 2 Samuel chapter 7 about David would one day have a son whose throne would go forever and ever, who would have an everlasting kingdom. How's that going to work out if all the sons are dead? Well, they weren't, but that was the report that got back to David. No doubt, David was absolutely devastated. And how does he respond? Verse 31. It says, then the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the earth, and all his servants stood by with their clothes rent. And Jonadab, Mr., you know, get it done guy, full of great ideas, said he was very clever, very subtle. You know, he's the one that came up with the plan for Amnon to get to his sister. He was the one that devised this whole scheme about pretending to be sick. So Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, answered and said, let not my lord suppose that they have slain all the young men of the king's sons, for Amnon only is dead. For by the appointment of Absalom, this hath been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar. So Mr. Jonadab comes along and says, wait a minute, it's not all that bad. Just Amnon's dead. Just your firstborn. Just the heir to the throne, you know, not all of your sons. And after all, you shouldn't be surprised because your other son, Absalom, your thirdborn, has been bent on his destruction ever since he forced his sister. So this should come as no surprise. So, you know, Mr. Jonadab's got it all figured out. Of course, he left out the part about how, you know, I'm the one, by the way, that devised a scheme that ended up in Tamar being raped and now Amnon being killed. He left that part out. But now he's trying to look like a good guy, saying, King, it's not all that bad. Only one son is dead. Now, therefore, verse 33, let not my lord the king take the thing to his heart to think that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon only is dead. But Absalom fled. We see that three times, verse 34, verse 37, verse 38. So Amnon is dead and Absalom fled. And the young men that kept the watch lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there came much people by the way of the hillside behind him. And Jonadab said unto the king, behold, the king's sons come. As thy servant said, so it is. And it came to pass, as soon as he had made an end of speaking, that behold, the king's sons came, lifted up their voice and wept. And the king also and all his servants wept very sore. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amihud, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there 3 years. And the soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead. So, word comes to the king that all your sons are dead. Well, that was wrong. Only Amnon was dead. So Jonadab is trying to sort of put things in perspective for him. But Absalom, of course, he's heading north. And he goes to his maternal grandfather, which is a place where he could find refuge, because now he's a criminal. He's in exile. And he was there for 3 years. He went to his maternal grandfather at Geshur, which was far enough away from Jerusalem to be out of David's jurisdiction. So Absalom flees and goes to Geshur. So now, what is the status of things now? Well, Amnon, the firstborn, the heir, is dead. Tamar has been raped, disgraced. Her life has been ruined. Absalom is now a murderer, a fugitive, and a grief to David. And you have to, you know, when you come to the end of a chapter like this, it's so heartbreaking. And it's, you know, by the way, we know that David lived to age 70. And commentators feel that he was about in his mid-60s when this happened. So he's at the very end of his life. This is not how you want to finish. Let me just tell you. This is not how you want to finish your life. Grieving as a result of the mistakes that you made. You have to stop and ask yourself the question, how would this story have been different? Now think about this for a minute. These are real people. These are real things that happen. There are real emotions involved here. How would this story have read if only David had disciplined Amnon in the first place? If David had done what he should have done in disciplining his son Amnon for raping his daughter, this would have been a totally different story. I don't think we would have seen Absalom killing him, devising a plan to kill him. Now, it's hard to know exactly what Absalom's motives were. Certainly, he was looking for a certain amount of retaliation against Amnon for what he did to his sister. No doubt about that. But you've also got to remember the fact that Amnon was the firstborn and heir to the throne. The second son was named Chileab, if that's how you say it. And commentators pretty universally agree that he died at a young age because he's not mentioned again. He was mentioned that he was born and you never hear of him again. So it's pretty safe to say he was off the scene. So now Absalom is the third born. Well, and the favored son. So with Amnon out of the way, that would put Absalom in line for the kingship. So just saying something to think about. But David was compromised, and all of this, all of these tragedies, all of this grief, all of this weeping and so forth, it went on for years now, we're talking about, for years. Ultimately, are consequences of David's sin, David's disobedience. Now, I want to ask you a question. I want you to look again at verse 37. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amihud, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day. Which son? Was he mourning for Amnon? Or was he mourning for Absalom? I'm going to expect an answer the next time we meet. So I'll give you something to think about. He mourned for his son every day. Now, I want to stop with this. I want to read verse 39 and just give you something else to think about. Because the next chapter is the chapter that talks about bringing Absalom back. You know, 2 years passed after Tamar had been violated. And then we read that Absalom spent 3 more years. So 5 years passed, 3 more years in exile. Verse 39, and the soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom. The soul of David longed to go forth to Absalom. Now, chapter 14, verse 1. I'm going to stop with this. Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was toward Absalom. Now, what I would suggest to you is that those statements are what I'll call neutral statements. The tendency is to read a verse like this, that the soul of King David longed to go forth to Absalom, you tend to think, well, because he loved him and he longed to be with him. That's sort of the way you would naturally tend to think, right? And then when you read that that Joab perceived that the king's heart was towards Absalom, you would tend to think it was a heart of love. I'm not so sure that heart, that longing to get to Absalom and his heart towards Absalom wasn't a heart of animosity rather than affection. And the reason I say that is because of what follows, which we'll get to next time. But what we're going to see is that David had to be tricked into bringing Absalom back. Okay, another parable is told and he gets convicted and he decides to bring Absalom back. But when he brings him back, what did he say? He says, I don't want to see his face for 2 years. Does that sound to you like a father that's just like the prodigal's father, couldn't wait to see the son and just hugged him and kissed him and killed the fatted calf and brought out the fine? That's not what we're talking about here. So I'm just want to suggest, be thinking about that, because when we look at chapter 14, I think you can make a pretty good case that David was still not on the best terms with Absalom. So we'll stop there.